This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We are continuing our coverage of the coronavirus today. Governor Charlie Baker announced earlier the latest projections for the virus in Massachusetts.
We estimate at this point in time that the number of confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Massachusetts will range somewhere between 47,000 and 172,000 cases during the course of the pandemic. That's about 0.7% to 2.5% of the total population of Massachusetts.
He also said early this afternoon that hospitalizations are expected to peak between April 10th and April 20th. As officials continue to fight for resources in the Commonwealth to combat the virus, so do members of Congress. And one of them, Congressman Jim McGovern of Massachusetts' 2nd District, joins us now from Washington. Welcome, Congressman.
Happy to be with you.
Well, let me ask you, how are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing?
You know what? I'm doing all right. I sure do appreciate you asking. Yeah. Let me ask, start with, you know, what do you make of the federal and the state response so far here in the Commonwealth?
Well, look, I think Governor Baker has done a good job. And I think a lot of our mayors and our city and town managers have done a great job. In Worcester, Mayor Petty and City Manager Augustus have led a coordinated effort. And I think people feel reassured that they're in charge and they're doing all that they can to get what we need. And on the federal level, I think Congress has stepped up to the plate. We've passed three major packages to provide support for our hospitals, our doctors and our nurses, our first responders. We just passed a major stimulus package to provide some direct assistance to individuals and small businesses. So that's good. But I think the president's performance, in my opinion, has been confused and disappointing. Look, I'm glad he's finally taking the advice of scientists and doctors and taking this this crisis seriously. But let's be candid. I think his delay in coming to the realization that this is a real crisis, that we have to take strong measures, I think his delay was deadly. And when this is over with, we're going to have to do a look back on what we were prepared for and what we weren't. But I think there should be a more coordinated effort coming out of this White House.
What about the pushback from some that it's not that the president was delaying as much as that he was being positive and hopeful at a time when that's what the country needs? We saw a Boston Globe op-ed today with data from people across political lines, and supporters of the president see and perceive his leadership in that light.
Well, I mean, give me a break, okay? I mean, he was calling it a hoax. He was basically saying it would go away with the warm weather. If that's reassuring to people, I think what would have been more reassuring is being candid with people and telling them the truth, so that people weren't shocked by the grim reality of how deadly this disease is. And by the way, the other thing, you know, that is a little bit frustrating, and I think I speak for a lot of the governors, including Governor Baker, is that notwithstanding these daily press conferences by the president and his team about how help is on the way and everything's going well, we know that hasn't been the case. Governors have expressed frustration over the federal government outbidding them for personal protective equipment. We still don't have a good answer on when we're going to reach our goal on testing. There's some mixed messages there. So, you know, I think the White House has to tighten up its coordination, and we need to make sure that the governors and the mayors and the city managers and our local communities get what they need to get through this crisis.
So let's stay with that for a minute. When we listened to Governor Baker earlier today, he talked about the approximately 1 million masks coming in through what he termed a private humanitarian mission. He's expressed frustration in the past with the federal government not being responsive. He also said today that of the 1,000 masks that were committed, ventilators that were committed, Commonwealth hasn't received those yet. And then we heard today from CNN that the Pentagon has a stockpile of up to 2,000 ventilators that are ready to be shipped, but they haven't done it because HHS and FEMA have not yet provided an address or a timeline for those. That report was 2 days ago. So what do you make of the picture that paints?
Yeah, well, it shows a lack of coordination. It shows an ineptness on behalf of the Trump administration in terms of being able to handle this crisis. I mean, look, all the relevant departments and agencies under the president's control should be meeting regularly, multiple times a day, figuring out what each of them can do and how they can coordinate their efforts and how they can get the help necessary to our states. I mean, you know, I think, and it's just, again, we're late into this. Again, he delayed in taking it seriously, I think, for far too long. But now here we are. And again, what's happening on the ground is not reflected in the rosy picture he paints in his press conferences. And look, at the end of the day, you know, and this is my advice to the president for what it's worth, you will get credit for doing the right thing. So, you know, you get your act together, get your administration focused on working together and working with our governors, and let's get the equipment that they need. Look, you know, when people hear that we may not have enough ventilators or we don't have enough personal protective equipment, people are shocked because, you know, we're the United States of America. I mean, during World War II, we transformed our factories into places that made airplane parts so we could be prepared and win World War II. I mean, the idea that we have a shortage on just the most basic protective gear is shocking. And the president should have invoked the Defense Production Act a long time ago to stockpile whatever we needed so that we had enough for everybody. But this latest report to the Department of Defense actually has ventilators, and nobody's getting them. I mean, that is a lack of leadership and a lack of coordination in the White House.
Congressman, I want to shift gears a little bit. You were talking about coordination earlier. Let's talk about coordination on the stimulus money that's set to start rolling out next week. What will that look like? How will people in the Commonwealth receive that money, and are we on track?
Yeah, well, I think one is we're doing all we can to make sure that we're on track. There are reports that there may be a slippage in terms of when people may get checks by a few days, but we are pressing the administration to make sure that they deliver all the resources to not only individuals but to small businesses or cities and towns and states, you know, as quickly as humanly possible. I mean, some people will receive checks electronically. Some will get checks in the mail. And the Small Business Administration is already taking applications and requests from small businesses for relief that is also on that package. So,
Congressman, you said a second ago there may be a slippage by a few days. So I can just hear listeners in my head saying, okay, so what day will it be? When should I start looking on my calendar for when that money might come to my household?
Yeah, well, I mean, I wanted it to arrive today or yesterday. And I think that the issue is whether or not the administration actually keeps to it. Their latest report says April 13th.
Okay.
That's when it's supposed to be starting. We had been originally told it would be April 6th. So that's the slippage here. Again, we want it to get to people as quickly as possible.
Now, you're also advocating for a fourth stimulus package. What do you want it to address, and why now, especially with the Republican pushback that we ought to wait and see how some of this $2 trillion package plays out before passing another one?
Yeah, well, we should be planning for a fourth stimulus package, and because we know we're going to need it. I mean, you know, this original package was designed when we were being told by the White House that, you know, this was only going to be a matter of a couple of weeks or a few weeks in terms of stopping our economy. It is clear now that this is going to go on much, much longer. Also, there are things that were not addressed appropriately in any of the packages that we have passed up to this point. I fought very hard to get an increase in SNAP benefits for individuals. The average SNAP benefit is about $1.40 per person per meal. And a lot of times people who are on SNAP end up going to other places to get additional food. Many of those places are shut down.
You mean like food pantries and food distribution centers?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We have to make sure that the most vulnerable don't get passed over during a crisis like this. I mean, I said to a group yesterday that, in the best of times, sadly, poor people get screwed over by government too often. In the worst of times, we have to make sure that we are caring for those who are most vulnerable. They, you know, things like food, and that's a basic necessity. We have to make sure that nobody goes without food during this crisis. So that may be something. We're going to have to address the issue of making sure our elections are safe. I mean, elections are coming up. We still have primaries going on. We have an election in November. We ought to provide states the resources to do voting by mail.
So can we pivot from there? I'm sorry to interrupt you. We have a limited amount of time, and there is one more thing I want to get to. You're the chair of the House Rules Committee. There is pressure among some House Democrats, including fellow Congresswoman Lori Trahan, to temporarily change the House rules to allow remote voting as the virus spreads through Congress. You've expressed reservations about that. Can you talk a little more about that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think we have to come to some sort of accommodation in terms of how we do business if we can't meet as a group. The problem is, you know, everybody has, you know, very simple solutions that aren't so simple. I mean, we have members who have varying degrees of expertise when it comes to technology. We have a bunch of members who still use flip phones. We have people who live in areas that, quite frankly, you know, have poor internet service. We know we have to worry about security issues that if we do, you know, FaceTime or Zoom or whatever, that we don't get hacked. I mean, there's all these different issues. So there are ways around that. I mean, I suggested one way around that was proxy voting. Those who could come here could come and basically vote for, you know, a colleague, you know, being told by that colleague how they would want us to vote. I mean, there are things like that. But we're now you know, figuring out ways to see how we can integrate technology with the way we do business. There may be some constitutional issues. There are also any change of the House rules requires a vote. And we have some Republicans who are uneasy with remote voting. We have some Democrats who are as well. But, you know, we're trying to resolve those differences and work with, you know, bipartisan way to come to some sort of solution.
And
we'll
Congressman,
figure this out.
So in our last 30 seconds with you, just what's your message to your constituents and to the people of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts?
My message is that, we're working very closely with the state and local officials. And, you know, I think in Massachusetts we are coordinating very, very well. This is a difficult time. Congress is going to do what it can to make sure that we respond with the resources necessary so we can get through this. We will get through this. And we need to make sure that we care about one another and that we follow the directions of the CDC. We stay home. And we remain safe. And I hope that everybody is safe. And again, if anybody in my district who has questions, call my office. My staff is working remotely from home, but we are there to take questions, to help you figure out the stimulus package, and to answer any other concerns that you may have.
That's Congressman Jim McGovern, who represents Massachusetts' 2nd District. Really appreciate you joining us today.
All the best.
WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins was listening to the conversation, joins us now for some analysis. Hey there, Kimberly.
Hi there.
So let me just start with your general reactions to what you heard from Congressman Jim McGovern.
Yes. Yeah, so one of the big takeaway here is that lawmakers are already at work for what the next recovery relief bill will be. I talked to Congressman McGovern and a number of other members of the Mass delegation yesterday, and in my newsletter that just went out this hour to inboxes, it talks about a lot of things that they said are still wanting, that there will be a need for more direct cash payments when even after these go out, that there will be a need for things like boosting SNAP benefits, protecting election security, boosting restaurants and the fishing industry, which is big in Massachusetts, and it's getting very hard hit. Homelessness and extending some of these benefits to immigrants who currently don't qualify for the benefits being offered in this $2 trillion package. So already lawmakers are focused ahead on the next one, whether they will find some opposition in the Senate. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has already said he wants to wait and see how this one plays out, but Democrats on both sides of the Capitol don't want to wait.
Kimberly, you talked about the cash payments that the forced stimulus might have more. We just heard Congressman McGovern talk about at least a week of push off further before the current cash payments arrive. Now we're looking at the middle of April. Is that a surprise? And is there something going on there that we should know about?
No, it's not that much of a surprise. Government moves slowly. Generally, anybody waiting for a normal tax return knows that sometimes it takes longer than they wanted. The initial payments now, April 13th, is the goalpost where that will start coming. That's for people who already have their bank information with the IRS. That's the fast payments. What really we need to look out for are people who don't have that, who don't submit their electronic payments, and they'll have to wait for paper checks. Those paper checks have to be printed, and you can only print so many at a time. A new report from CNN just coming out within the last hour saying that it could take as many as 20 weeks to print them all, which means some people will have to wait months for this payment.
All right. So, Kimberly, I do want to grab one other thing with you. What have you heard about Speaker Nancy Pelosi's new select committee to oversee the federal coronavirus response?
Well, what she's creating is a select committee with subpoena power, like other select committees, that will have the ability to look at the way this administration has reacted to the coronavirus response, as well as how this $2 trillion relief package is being carried out. With that subpoena power, with that ability to move, of course, the $2 trillion package itself came with some oversight, but that will take time. It calls for the appointment of an inspector general, for example, but he has to be nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate, which can't happen with everybody gone during this quarantine. So it will give some more immediate power to the House.
Kimberly, literally like 20 seconds. Will there be pushback that this is politicizing an important moment?
Absolutely. Republicans are already saying that this is just an effort by Democrats to do another inquiry after the impeachment and that this doesn't have to do with the recovery. Speaker Pelosi disagrees and says that oversight is needed.
That's WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins. That was great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we're continuing our coverage of the coronavirus pandemic with a look at how it's impacting the arts. In a few minutes, we'll speak with two independent artists locally. But first, Anita Walker, executive director of the Mass Cultural Council, joins us. Anita, welcome to Radio Boston.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So maybe, Anita, begin by giving us the overall picture. How does it look for our cultural institutions in the Commonwealth?
Well, it's a dire situation. In fact, it's the most unprecedented damage that's been done by the economy and this pandemic that, quite frankly, I've seen in my entire career. Just a couple of weeks into the closing of our organizations and the pandemic really becoming reality here in Massachusetts, we issued a survey to individual artists and to organizations in the Commonwealth, asking them to tell us how they felt and what the impact has been. This was just maybe 2 weeks into the coronavirus reaching Massachusetts. We had more than 1,000 respondents to our surveys, which is quite surprising and stunning response as far as we were concerned. And even just a couple of weeks into the coronavirus hitting Massachusetts, we had already measured nearly $56 million of revenue losses to our organizations. That's real losses in real time. Not projected losses already to these institutions, and millions of dollars in income had been lost to our individual working artists and cultural workers.
Let's pick up there for a second, Anita, just because last week MassMoCA laid off 120 of its 165 employees. You're talking about losses to individuals. That's the first major Massachusetts museum to do this kind of wide-scale layoff since the pandemic began. Is there more of that coming? Are we going to see more unemployment among the cultural institutions as well as loss of income for individual artists?
We're already seeing it. As a matter of fact, the Box Center in Boston laid off half of its staff a week ago Friday, and that's maybe about 50 people that are working regularly at the Box Center, but it doesn't even mention the hundreds and hundreds of other workers who would have had a job on the some 70 performances that have been canceled as a result of the coronavirus. Jacob's Pillow has canceled its season in the Berkshires for the first time in its entire history. They typically have over 100 people in residence at Jacob's Pillow. And that doesn't even bring into mind the ripple effect on hotels, on restaurants, on all the other businesses that really derive a lot of their income from the presence of these cultural assets.
Anita, I know you were part of a listening session today. There were members of the state legislature, and it was on the economic impacts on our cultural sector. From that, what help is out there? What's in the pipeline? What's coming?
Well, I was really interested to the conversation that you were just having with Congressman McGovern about the economic stimulus bill. One of the pieces of that bill that we are paying close attention to is the one coming through the SBA that would provide a loan to cover 3 or 4 months of losses to small businesses and nonprofits, including our cultural nonprofit sector. There's just shy of $400 billion in that bill, and it's available to every single small business, small being defined as having 500 or fewer employees, and every single nonprofit in America. That is not going to go as far as it needs to. What we're doing at the Mass Cultural Council is we're addressing this in two ways. Next week, we are putting forth our council meeting for approval, two relief programs. One is aimed at individual artists, and it would provide $1,000 grants to working artists who can attest to the fact that they've lost at least $1,000 of income, which is not going to be difficult for most of them, equally for cultural workers, independent contractors, teaching artists, and the like. Then in terms of our organizations, we're really putting a package together to help them navigate and find safe harbor in these very difficult times. We call the program Safe Harbor. It will provide intensive technical assistance to, first of all, assess and evaluate their current financial states, how to make decisions, how to create scenarios, and how to tell their story. But importantly, it will also give them very specific technical assistance and advice on how to access and apply for these federal stimulus funds.
So
in addition to that, we are also providing flat grants to probably between 300 and 400 organizations in the Commonwealth.
So in our last 30 seconds or so with you, Anita, where are you finding hope right now?
I'm finding hope in our field. They are so resilient. They are hard hit. They are really damaged, but they are not stopping the work. They know how important and meaningful their work is, especially at a time like this when people are sequestered at home. So they're finding new and creative ways to deliver music, to deliver arts, to continue the relationship with children who they used to serve in the classroom. It's amazing to me the optimism and innovation. Well, it's not amazing because that's who they are. They are continuing to serve our public.
Thanks so much. That's Anita Walker, Executive Director of the Massachusetts, the Mass Cultural Council. Appreciate it, Anita.
Thank you.
So let's turn now to two independent artists, photographer O.J. Slaughter. They also do freelance photography for WBUR's The Artery. And also Eric Bornstein. He's been working as a mask maker in Somerville since the 1980s. Welcome to both of you.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So O.J., let's start with you. How are you and how are you faring right now?
You know, it's interesting. I'm not really sure. And I think it changes as the day progresses. I catch myself getting into like a creative rhythm and working with different materials. And then I'm like, oh, maybe I should go outside. And it hits me the gravity of everything going on. This is my 22nd day inside. Mm. So just finding new ways to create and started working on some soft sculpture, which is so new to me. So yeah, finding a little bit of hope in my work.
I'm glad to hear that part. Eric, a lot of your planned income has evaporated. What are you focused on right now and what's your biggest concern?
Well, right now I'm emerging from my cocoon. About 4 weeks ago, we were just stunned with this news. I was just pulling into my driveway on a Thursday. I had a week-long residency. And when I pulled into my driveway, I got the phone call not to come in on Friday. And that was the day everything froze. And then from that moment on, it just escalated. All my future bookings just evaporated. And I was actively engaged in booking summer and even 2021 dates. And that all just ceased. Everything just got put on hold. Classes that were scheduled were canceled. I had a new semester of classes that was supposed to begin April 8th, and that all has gone away. All those classes are canceled now. I'm trying to adapt to the situation here with Zoom. I just got off of a Zoom studio chat. I pulled out some works that I've been doing and did kind of a show and tell and talk about my work and how I do it and why I do it, and then also why it's important to do it in this particular trying times.
Thanks for that, Eric. OJ, I want to pick up on something you said where you talked about essentially a new medium that you are working in. This is an unprecedented moment. I don't know you, but I'm assuming you haven't been through a lot of other things like this. How does that affect how you engage with your art, your creative process, and how does your creative process feed you now?
I am an extrovert, but I wouldn't say I'm incredibly social. I get a lot of my social time through taking pictures of people. A lot of the base of my work is kind of documenting history as it happens. And without being able to connect physically in person with people, I've had to change my medium through shooting people through FaceTime. So I've been doing a lot of call people up, pose people, style them, and adjust the lighting in their own rooms and shooting them that way so that I'm still having this social time and allowing myself to document history in another way. But I also found that my eyes were constantly on a screen, so I started sewing. Not very well, but I am making little characters and stuffed sculptures that are kind of helping me pass time.
And Eric, how about you?
Well, like this morning, I taught a self-portrait drawing class. I set up a tripod in my studio and a little table easel, 9x11 drawing pad, and a mirror, and designed a little four-session curriculum. And so this was the first one, and it went really well. I think with Zoom, I occasionally have some problems with freezing, but it was a successful class, and we got a lot done, and I follow up on Facebook. I'm starting to engage my Facebook followers very differently. Everything has kind of shifted because we're talking about, our art is dealing with the here and now in a very poignant way. And everything that we do is we're acting as role models for hope and creativity for trying to find a way through this. We're all groping our way in the dark and just sort of feeling into the future. We're not really sure what we're doing, but we're kind of listening to the process and getting more and more tuned in to how to shape-shift and how to recreate ourselves to move forward.
OJ.
But of course,
Eric, go ahead.
Yes. But of course, in the meanwhile, the bills are still piling up. And while we find ourselves, we have to find new ways to generate income.
So, OJ, to that point, we heard Anita at the top of this segment from the Mass Cultural Council talking about the level of hit, economic hit to our cultural institutions and our artists. What do you need most from people in our community now?
That's a great question. I found about half of my annual salary has disappeared because of social distancing and because of canceling all of these events, which of course needs to happen. I think the best way to support me right now is you can buy my prints, which is really helping create a cushion for me financially, and that can be done on my website, which is just ojslaughter.com. But I also think it comes down to just checking in with people. Like, make sure that you're supporting your community on a larger level than a financial level. Sometimes really just reaching out and being like, hey, are you good? Do you need anything? means so much in these times.
And Eric, in your comments so far, you've really brought home on an individual and a personal level what the economic risk and the economic loss is to our cultural institutions and to our individual artists. As of last week, you had not applied for any grants or anything like that. We heard Anita talk today, for example, about the loans available through the SBA. Will you move in that direction at some point? Will you start seeking financial relief through various programs and opportunities?
Yes, I'll have to. And in fact, it's long overdue. I'm just not, like so many artists, I'm really not good at filling out those forms and applications. It creates even a higher level of anxiety just to seek them out and fill them out and try to complete them properly. Often as artists, we're so good at creating magic in our studios with our chosen art form, but filling out these forms and applications is often paralyzing. And so I've been doing everything else, but I haven't gotten to any of those yet. But I do hope to.
When this passes, And I stay optimistic that I can phrase it that way. And you have an opportunity, yeah, both of you, to bring your art back out in the world, out of the virtual world and into the tactile world. What's the first thing each of you wants to do? OJ?
So my happy place in Boston is the Arboretum. I would love to just get a bunch of people together and make magic in the Arboretum. Like, just be in my space and connect with others. Like, I so miss leaning on my community in person. Even if I'm not creating, I'd love to make a meal and just see people and catch up. I think that'll be my first step, especially since people are what fuels my creativity. I think that's what's most important to me.
And Eric, how about you?
Well, I'd like to join OJ at the Arboretum, one of my happy places too. And in fact, all the happy places, mostly, you know, when I think of the happy places, it's usually places in nature. I need them more than ever. They're always places that replenish my soul. And I think we all need them more than ever. Just the freedom to be out and to just be without this hanging over us. I'm just longing for the company of my community, and you know, even on Zoom, it's so nice to hear people's voices and see their faces.
That's so
to see them in person will be so nice. To get hugs, I miss hugs.
You know, I do too, Eric. Yeah, Eric, I think you've tapped into it for all of us with that. That's Somerville-based puppeteer and mask maker Eric Bornstein. We'll have information about his work and drawing classes at RadioBoston.org. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you so much.
And photographer OJ Slaughter. For a link to view or purchase their work, you can also visit our website, RadioBoston.org, and we'll include more information about the Arteries Living Room live stream with OJ, which will kick off on Friday. With so many of us at home, plus the complications of grocery shopping at the moment, we have a new collective dilemma. How do we cook and prepare meals day after day with what we've got in our cupboards? Especially now, cooking, comforts, food, sharing our favorites with the people we love, it feels really important. So this afternoon, we invite you to our kitchen table, and we want to hear about yours. What are you preparing? What are you cooking, baking while you're at home? Any recipes from what you had on the shelf already that you're particularly proud of? Share your favorites. Ask your questions. Call us. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining us from her table is fellow New Englander Dori Greenspan. She is a, get this, 5-time James Beard Award-winning author. Her latest cookbook is Everyday Dori, which is a collection of simple, delicious recipes that don't require special skills or new gear to make. Dori Greenspan has written 12 other cookbooks, including the bestsellers Around My French Table and Baking with Julia, and she writes a column for the New York Times Magazine. We are lucky to have her join us today. Dori, welcome back to Radio Boston.
I'm so happy to be, actually, I'm in my kitchen.
Perfect.
I'm leaning against the kitchen counter, and I'm glad to have you all with me. Thank you. Thank you for visiting.
Absolutely. Well, Dori, you get it. This is how we feel, too. We feel like we're all at the big kitchen table together, and let's talk about what we're cooking during these extraordinary circumstances. So let me just start by asking you, how are you? How are you faring these days?
I'm doing okay. I consider myself very lucky, and I'm holding on to wood as I say this, because I'm home with my husband, and our son and daughter-in-law, who live in New York City, have come to live with us. So it's a very odd, surreal, dark time, and yet lovely that our family is together. So how are you doing?
Yeah, I appreciate you asking. I was thinking about this last night. Long story short, I was up at like 1:30 in the morning for a minute, and my son came shuffling into the kitchen. He's a teenager, and he was hungry, and he just wanted me to make him something. So we did the ever fancy Ritz crackers and peanut butter and wound up talking for a little bit, and it just made me think about how important it is to be in the kitchen with family at this time.
Yes. You know, always been true. I always talk about the joy of making something with your hands and being able to share it. And you and I, are lucky because we have We have family with us. Many of my friends are alone now. But I'm encouraging them to cook. No matter what, whether you're with family or you're alone, there's something really satisfying, deeply, deeply satisfying about cooking, transforming ingredients, making something that's delicious.
In a moment, I'm going to ask Dori what's in her pantry. We want to know what's in yours, too. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What are you turning to for comfort? What are you cooking? Or what are you making stretch in these very difficult financial times? Dori, what's in your fridge and in your cupboard or pantry right now?
Well, I'm laughing because today I got, quite by accident, a gallon of Thai sweet chili sauce.
How do you do that by accident?
I pressed the wrong button.
Got it.
So I am hoping that my neighbors like Thai sweet chili sauce because I have enough for the entire block and then some. And I'm going to be sharing that with a recipe so that they'll know what to do with it. But in my cupboard, you know, I have pretty much what I always have. I have spices. I have flour. I feel like I'm very lucky to have flour since that's been, the supermarket shelves have been bare.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Of flour. And yeah, I just brought flour over to a neighbor who had never baked bread before and thought this was the time she would like to start, but she had neither flour nor yeast. So I brought her some. I have lots of vinegars. I think of my refrigerator door as part of my pantry. I've always kept a lot of condiments, lots of mustard, lots of Asian chili pastes, things that can make something, can just lift something so that even if it's a very simple pasta dish, a little bit of spice, a little bit of heat can really change the flavors and make them more exciting. And so I often shop my refrigerator door when I'm cooking.
So, Dori, I think we've got callers who want to talk to you. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ellen from Brookline, you are on with Dori.
Hi, Dori.
Hi, Ellen.
For the very first time in my entire lifetime, I made chicken parmesan. And the only reason I started with chicken was because I was never independently wealthy enough to afford veal. But it came out fantastic. I just made it on Wednesday, and I had some full for lunch today.
Isn't that great? It was delicious. And that you can have a second meal out of it. Do you know what I like? I like chicken parmesan without the parmesan. So sometimes
I use mozzarella cheese. I don't even use parmesan.
Yeah, but next time if you want to change it up, why don't you make it and just squeeze some lemon juice over it and put your green salad on top of the chicken. It's a really nice dish. It goes from chicken parmesan to being called chicken milanese. So it goes kind of
confused. What juice do I put on it before I put the salad on top of it or something? What?
Lemon. Some lemon juice.
Oh, wine. Okay.
No.
I bet you could use wine,
Ellen. I'm a big fan of putting wine on most things, but I think Dori was telling you to put some lemon juice on it before put the salad on.
Yeah.
Oh, lemon juice gives everything punch. Sure, yeah. Lemon juice, yeah.
Ellen, I'm with you. I think if you have a lemon and you have salt, you can make probably anything except chocolate chip cookies taste better.
So, Ellen, we're going to wish you well, and I hope you'll call back and let us know if you try it with lemon juice and salad. We've got Shayna on the line now. Let me put the number out again for other callers. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to share your cooking successes in this area of seriously being at home with Dori Greenspan. Shayna, you're on with Dori. Shayna's from Lynn. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, Shayna.
I'm good.
Good. I hope you're good, too.
Good, thanks. I am. Hanging in there during this craziness. I just wanted to let you guys know my pantry is stocked. In February, I made my twice-a-year purchase from Rancho Gordo. They do amazing heirloom beans. Yeah, yep. So I have, like, 10 pounds of beans in my cupboard right now. And along with, you know, cans of tomatoes, greens, I'm in good shape.
So, Dory, what
there's
can
a
yeah.
new, well, I was, excuse me, I was going to say there's a new book, and you can find several of the recipes from it online. It's by Joe Yonan, who's the food editor of the Washington Post, and it's called Cool Beans.
Cool
Beans. Oh, yeah, I just saw that.
Cool Beans, yep. And it's just great bean recipes, some traditional, so many of them surprising. And you were really smart to get your Rancho Gordo order in. I was late, and so mine will be here next week. I've been waiting for it. but those are delicious. Those are great beans. And beans they're just, beans will hold you through. Soup, a casserole, in a salad, with greens. Beans are really, I think a lot of people will be learning to love beans now. And that would be a good thing to come out of this.
All right, so we're going to say goodbye to Shayna, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now we've got Emily on from Easton. Emily, you're on with Dory Greenspan. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Emily. We're homeschoolers, so we're home. We're home a lot anyway, so I'm used to cooking for the family. We do a lot with frozen vegetables, rice, frozen meatballs, things that are quick to grab and easy to make.
Mm-hmm.
So, Emily, do you, as a homeschooler, is cooking a way that you can incorporate lessons for your kids? Is the kitchen a piece of how you teach?
Oh, yeah, definitely. They make their breakfast on their own and know how to make eggs, and they do a lot.
So, Dory, what about that? What can we learn from being in the kitchen together?
It's interesting. Sometimes I think we can learn patience, first of all, because cooking is but usually not instantaneous. But three cheers for you, Emily, because you're really juggling a lot. I think that there's a lot to learn. There's a way of organizing when you put all of your ingredients out, when you get ready to cook. There's a way to learn about cleaning up after yourself, cleaning after you do something. There are, of course, fractions and things to learn. And there are just the techniques of stirring. Cooking takes all of your senses. So as a cook, you're looking to see how things change. You're even listening to how something sizzles if you're sautéing. You can feel something to tell if it's done. And, of course, we get to smell and taste it. So I think there are hundreds of lessons. You just need to bring your children into the kitchen and let them learn with you.
So 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dorothea is on the line from Manchester, New Hampshire. Do you have a question, Dorothea?
I do. I have tried over and over to make bread and pretty much given up. And I'm thinking at these times, I need to learn. Do you have any suggestions? Because when I mix my bread and ask it to rise, it just kind of sits there.
So Dorothea, I'm going to step in first because I make a lot of bread recipes. I'm a big fan of it. And often what happens for me is if I'm not careful and the salt comes in contact with the yeast too early on, we get what in my house is called a disaster loaf. Now, I confess we then eat said disaster loaf and it's kind of like this really dense floury thing. But Dory, maybe. Yeah, exactly. And they're actually still kind of tasty, just not very pretty. But Dory, is there a go-to bread recipe that you like or a bread cookbook that you like that you would recommend for people who are trying to, you know, enhance their bread making skills? I know that's quite popular right now with people at home.
It's so popular. So my husband is the bread baker. I do the fancy breads. I do brioche. Or I do a challah or a rich egg bread. But I really, the one, I mean, it's the no-knead bread. It's the famous no-knead bread that really you can find it online everywhere. It was Jim Leahy's recipe, and Mark Bittman made it popular. If you can master that, then you get to play around. You get to play around with different grains. You get to play around with the way you add things to it. Bread is not meat. So, Tiziana, your advice is good. But the salt that you talked about,
yeah.
No, the salt is really, really important. That will impede rising. And are you using instant yeast?
I actually think we lost Dorothea, so why don't you just tell her the lesson about instant yeast?
Well, instant yeast is, you can abuse instant yeast more than you can other yeast. And so
excellent.
You have to be careful with regular yeast. Yeah, be careful with temperature.
So
you don't want it to be too hot, the water to be too hot.
So, Dori, one of the things that we lose in talking about cooking, now that in the age of social distancing, you and I can't be in the same room, is I can't eat anything you've made, which I feel cheated out of something delicious, but I do
understand. And I can't give it to you.
I know.
It makes me feel like half of the equation is missing.
Exactly. But I do understand that you actually just pulled something out of the oven, and I thought maybe you could taste it and tell us about it.
Oh, well, actually, now would be the perfect time because it's the right temperature.
Excellent.
So I am working on a new cookbook on a baking. Wait, let me just get a fork out of here. Okay. I'm working on a new baking cookbook, and I am making a tart tatin, which is essentially an upside-down apple pie and apple tart. And this is my third try in as many days. I've made tart tatin before. I have a recipe for it in Baking From My Home to Yours, but I had a new idea about how to do it, a way of caramelizing the apples first. And so that's what I've been trying. And may I really talk with a mouthful?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll just, while you take your bite, I will tell you that the idea of having caramelized apples right now makes me feel particularly cheated out of not being able to try your creation. How is it there?
So I'm going to have to do it again. The apples are because the apples are really good, but they're too soft. However, I changed my crust. I'm making this with an all-butter pie crust, which is not at all French nor traditional. And boy, is that good.
So you like it with the all-butter crust?
I do. I really do. Often it's done with puff pastry. And I think with this crust against the apples that are too soft but won't be next time, I hope, this is on its way. Test form might be it.
So let me just ask you.
I wish you were here.
I know, I do too. In our last 30 seconds, Dori, what might make the apples less soft next time?
Oh, I could cook them less.
Oh, well, that makes perfect sense.
I bake them for a very long time. I think they could take with less heat. They'd be fine with less heat.
Well, Dori Greenspan is a 5-time James Beard Award-winning author. Her latest cookbook is Everyday Dori. She writes a column for the New York Times Magazine. It has been such a treat to have you. Thanks for joining us today.
Next time in real life, in person.
I cannot wait. I can't wait to taste the apples.